hat him. Ikshiah, by looking on Eber, simply Ashu, immediately, Gata, having gone away, Yudha, from the arrows, Shrama, fatigue, Nivritta, being stopped, Sarva, all, Indriya, senses, Vritti, activities, Vibrahma, being widely engaged, Tushtava, he prayed, Janyam, the material tabernacle, Vishrajan, while quitting Janardhanam, to the controller of the living beings. Translation and purport. By pure meditation, looking at Lord Sri Krishna, he at once was freed from all material inauspiciousness and was relieved of all bodily pains caused by the arrow wounds. Thus, all the external activities of his senses at once stopped, and he prayed transcendentally to the controller of all living beings while quitting his material body. The material body is a gift of the material energy, technically called illusion. Identification with the material body is due to forgetfulness of our eternal relationship with the Lord. For a pure devotee of the Lord, like Bhishma Dev, this illusion was at once removed as soon as the Lord arrived. Lord Krishna is like the sun, and the illusory external material energy is like darkness. In the presence of the sun, there is no possibility that darkness can stand. Therefore, just on the arrival of Lord Krishna, all material contamination was completely removed, and Bhishma Dev was thus able to be transcendentally situated by stopping the activities of the impure senses in collaboration with matter. The soul is originally pure, and so also the senses. By material contamination, the senses assume the role of imperfection and impurity. By revival of contact with the Supreme Pure Lord Krishna, the senses again become freed from material contaminations. Bhishma Dev attained all these transcendental conditions prior to his leaving the material body because of presence of the Lord. The Lord is the controller and benefactor of all living beings. That's the verdict of all Vedas. He's the supreme eternity and living entity amongst all the eternal living beings. Nityo nityananam chetanas chetananam ekabahunam yo vidadatikam, from the Kati Upanishad. And Krishna alone provides all necessities for all kinds of living beings. Thus he provided all facilities to fulfill the transcendental desires of his great devotee, Sri Bhishma Dev, who began to pray as follows. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srim Te Bhaktivedanta Swami Te Nomine Namaste Saraswati Dev Gaurumani Pacharine Nirvisesa Sunyavadi Paschatate Sitarine Vishuddhaya Naranaya Hattashubhas tad ikshaya vasu kata yudhishrama nivritta sarvendriya vitti viprama stushtavan janyam visrajan janardhanam. Just a word of introduction, because I haven't been in New Dwarka, and you may not know who I am. My service in ISKCON is literary. I served at the Back to Godhead magazine. I was on the staff for 5 years, and I learned how to edit and write articles. Since 1993, I have stayed in Europe or India editing books and writing BTG articles. One article that appeared in Back to Godhead magazine about Bhishma Dev in the 1980s was written by Ravindra Swarup, and today I'll recap that article. The encounter between Krishna and Bhishma wasn't a hostile clash of enemies, as it appears to be. On the contrary, it was a reciprocation of deep love, the deepest love between Krishna and a great devotee. And both Krishna and Bhishma derived transcendental bliss in this encounter. Today's purport says that the Supreme Personality of Godhead gave Bhishma the facility to fulfill his transcendental desires. The Bhagavatam relates many pastimes between Krishna and pure devotees like Bhishma. The Bhagavatam shows that relationships with Krishna are rich and attractive, surcharged with ecstasy, and filled with powerful emotions and fascinating exchanges. When we hear the Bhagavatam narrations, they act as an antidote to a poison, the poisonous stereotype of a remote god, a static, not an ecstatic, a static, unsociable god, a god who is too aloof to fully enter into relationships, a god who is inaccessible, a god who you wouldn't really care to know. This subtle and harmful idea of God has led many people to think that relations with God must be empty and one-sided, and that spiritual life is boring and dull. To these people, godless relationships seem far more interesting. The humorist and writer Mark Twain spoke for these people when he quipped, "I'll take heaven for the climate, and I'll take hell for the association, for the society, because you meet a lot of interesting characters in hell. And God doesn't seem as interesting." So people aren't inspired. The purport says that the soul and the senses are originally pure. And by material contamination, the senses are imperfect and impure. But by contact with the Supreme Pure, the senses again become uncontaminated, and the soul attains a transcendental condition. The words are used that Bhishma became free from inauspiciousness. So each of us possesses a relationship with Krishna as part of our eternal makeup, but we seek happiness in relationships disconnected from Krishna. To encourage us in Krishna prema, Krishna revealed some of his pastimes in the Bhagavatam so that we see that there's no society like Krishna's and there's no love like Krishna's love. We can withdraw from contaminated activities by engaging in transcendental activities, and we can experience ecstasy. Bhishma was the grandsire of the Kurus, a brave warrior, a brilliant general, and an authority on religious principles. Although he felt extremely affectionate toward the Pandavas, and he repeatedly warned the Kauravas not to act wickedly against their cousins, Bhishma had been obliged to fight against the Pandavas because he was maintained by Duryodhana. Duryodhana had cheated the Pandavas of their share of the kingdom. To appreciate how important kingship or ruling was to the Pandavas, we should understand Dharma. The Sanskrit root dhr, dr, means to support or sustain. Dharma denotes the fundamental basis of a thing, that by which something is what it is, its nature, its character. The dharma of fire is to burn. The dharma of sugar is sweetness. Every human has a twofold dharma, one permanent dharma and one temporary dharma. All entities are eternal and subordinate particles of God. So our permanent eternal dharma, our essential unchangeable nature, is to serve God. Now, one may object that since many people quite plainly don't serve God, that cannot be everyone's unavoidable dharma. But the people who appear not to be serving God really are serving Him. They just do it unwillingly. To serve somebody means to be controlled by somebody's order. And since everyone necessarily is controlled by God, everyone serves Him. Those who serve God willingly are directly and favorably controlled by God, and they enter into eternal life. But those who rebel against God, seeking independence, serve God unwillingly. They're controlled by Him indirectly and unfavorably through the material nature, through Maya. And therefore, they must suffer repeated birth and death. So service to God is our dharma. So we must serve. Nevertheless, we have freedom. How to serve God is up to us. Willingly or unwillingly, directly, indirectly, favorably, unfavorably. In addition to this permanent dharma pertaining to the soul, there's a supplementary dharma pertaining to the body. It's temporary, and it applies only to civilized human beings. in the Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna that the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras are his creation. Actually, it's Lord Vishnu's creation. Lord Vishnu endows the Varnas, the divisions of society, with appropriate qualities and aptitudes, and thus the four Varnas are natural to human society, just as the head, the arms, the belly, and the legs are natural to the human body. It's said that the Brahmins come from the head of Vishnu, the Kshatriyas from Lord Vishnu's arms, the universal Lord Vishnu, and so on. And the dharma of each social group is constituted of a particular constellation of duties and obligations, injunctions, prohibitions, and moral and ethical values. By virtue of one's nature and one's education, one's dharma constitutes one's own self. Thus, if you go against dharma, it's not just wrong, but it violates your very nature. The Vedic society was God-centered, so the permanent and the temporary dharmas were in harmony. The members executed their particular duties as a service to God. Bhagavad Gita says, yagnartat karmano nyatra loko yam karma bandana. You should work as a sacrifice to Vishnu, yagnartat karmano. This kind of work will liberate you. Otherwise, action is bondage. Yagnartat karmano nyatra lokoyam karma bandana. So the members of Vedic society were able to act and also be in harmony with their spiritual dharma, their service to God. So the Pandavas, for example, were pursuing their dharma in relation to society, and also they fulfilled their dharma in relation to God. The Pandavas were great devotees. They were so great that Krishna played the part of their friend and their kinsman. And Krishna wanted the pious devotional Pandavas rather than the impious Kauravas, their cousins, to rule the earth. Krishna descended to earth to reestablish dharma. And the purpose of the great Kurukshetra war was to reestablish dharma. The Pandavas were Krishna's chosen instruments. And in that war, Krishna himself did not fight. Why? The Kauravas objected that the Pandavas would have an unfair advantage if the all-powerful Lord fought on their side. Krishna therefore took a vow that he would not take up weapons and he would take part strictly as the chariot driver, as a non-combatant. In Bhishma's case, it appears that his temporary dharma as a kshatriya was in conflict with his eternal dharma as a devotee. His eternal dharma as a devotee bound him in love to the Lord, but his temporary dharma as a kshatriya bound him to his patron Duryodhana. So there seems to be a conflict, but in fact there was no disparity in the dharma of Bhishma. as a pure devotee, he acts, a pure devotee acts in obedience to the Lord. And the real reason that Bhishma fought for the Kauravas was that Krishna wanted him to do that. That was part of Krishna's plan. Krishna was controlling the situation. Krishna had two purposes to fulfill. First, he wanted the Kauravas to have every possible advantage, and it was a great advantage to have Bhishma Dev. Then, when the Kauravas went down in defeat, the whole world would see that even though the side of vice was very well favored, it was not able to conquer virtue. Krishna's second purpose was more confidential. In the kind of relationship that Krishna and Bhishma enjoyed, their love for one another, their love for each other, was aroused, intensely aroused, by fighting. This was the confidential purpose of Krishna's having Bhishma fight against the Pandavas. Krishna placed Bhishma in the opposing ranks to set the stage for a mutually satisfying fight. So we can understand more about this relationship between the Lord and his warrior devotee by considering the idea of rasa. Rasa refers to love, the taste of love, the flavor of love. It depends on the kind of relationship. Just like a fan of a celebrity. A fan of a celebrity tastes a certain rasa. A loyal worker, someone who really likes his job, likes his boss. He loves his boss. A person loves friends. Parents love children. Husbands love wives. And these are all relations of love. And the quality of love, the emotional flavor of love, is distinct in each relationship. These distinct emotional characteristics are called rasa. We experience rasas in this world, but no matter how intense they are, they're stale. They're juiceless copies of the rasas in the spiritual world. The rasas in this world are reflected into this world like a mirage in a desert. So there's no real nectar in them compared to the spiritual rasas, the real rasas with God, in relation with God. To show us this, the Bhagavatam tells us about hundreds of fascinating encounters between the Lord and the devotees. And expert devotees like Srila Rupa Goswami have analyzed the Bhagavatam, and they've listed 12 rasas and divided them into two categories, direct and indirect. A direct rasa is situated permanently in the heart of a devotee. A direct rasa is situated permanently in the heart of a devotee. Whereas an indirect rasa will suddenly appear under certain conditions. Now, the idea of Dharma that we were talking about says that the living entity is God's eternally subordinate servant, and the idea of rasa holds that a devotee can act as the Lord's equal or superior. Of course, the living entity is never equal or superior to the Lord. But when the Lord wants to taste feelings that arise in intimate relationships, he allows a devotee to become a companion, a parent, or a lover. by causing the devotee to forget the immense differences between them. The devotee remains a subordinate servant. Ontologically and psychologically, by the will of the Lord, he becomes the Lord's equal or superior. So here's the main point of the class I'm going to say now. Rasas are thus pure service to Krishna, the highest expressions of Dharma. If you can get into a rasa, that's the perfection of Dharma. Krishna is known as the reservoir of all rasas because he's eternally enjoying pastimes of love with devotees. And he's relishing an unlimited variety of emotions and feelings. Devotees who are in various rasas serve Krishna by satisfying his desire to enjoy in particular ways. We all enter into relationships, and so does God. Of course, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is without the limitations and the faults of ordinary persons. Nor can God's transcendental body be injured by arrows or ravaged by age and disease and death. So his relationships don't have the well-known shortcomings that make our relationships so problematic. All of our relationships break up at the time of death. Death means you can no longer sustain relationships, but Krishna can sustain relationships eternally. So when we hear that God likes to fight, we shouldn't have some misgivings about that. The fighting propensity is found in us, and thus it originally exists in God. Everything that we experience originally exists in God. There are unique pleasures in a fight. In a fight, the mind becomes intensely concentrated, and the senses are heightened. There's excitement in the contest and adventure. There's the thrill of being challenged by danger. And there's exhilaration in the testing of one's strength and courage. Of course, in the material world, fighting is polluted or contaminated by hate and enmity. And nowadays, fighting and wars have degraded into terrorism and indiscriminate butchery of citizens. To understand the relationship between Krishna and Bhishma in this fight, we need to consider the dharma of Kshatriyas. They observed the rules of chivalry in their fighting. They didn't fight against citizens. They only fought with equals and so on. There were many rules. It was all chivalrous, but now that chivalry has disappeared from fighting. So we might have a bad idea of fighting. But when Krishna wants to enjoy the pleasure of fighting with an appropriate devotee, and enjoy the feelings of love enhanced by combat, then he engages with a devotee like Bhishma Dev. And Bhishma Dev yearned, he desired to serve Krishna in this way. This was Bhishma's rasa of chivalry. it was an indirect rasa. We mentioned there are direct rasas that are permanently in the heart of a devotee, and there are indirect rasas caused by circumstances. Bhishma's permanent rasa was servitude to the Lord. But this was combined with the more prominent indirect rasa of chivalry. So Krishna was eager to be attacked by Bhishma because he loved Bhishma and Bhishma loved him. As the supreme controller in everybody's heart, Krishna caused Bhishma to take a vow that on one particular day he would slay all the Pandavas. And Bhishma also swore that Krishna would have to take up weapons, breaking his vow. Otherwise, Arjuna would die. So in this fight, waves of lethal arrows from Bhishma's bow crashed down on Arjuna's chariot. There were curtains of arrows, and behind these curtains of arrows, Arjuna and Krishna disappeared. It looked certain that Arjuna was about to fall in the fight. So Krishna suddenly stopped the chariot and he jumped to the ground. He raised the wheel of a disabled chariot over his head and raced toward Bhishma like a lion charging an elephant. And then Bhishma stopped shooting arrows. His bow dropped to the ground. He stood unarmed and he stared with wide open eyes at the Lord charging toward him to kill him by hurling this wheel. Bhishma saw the Lord's beautiful flowing black hair had turned gray from the dust in the battle. He saw the beads of sweat on Krishna's face, which were like dewdrops on a blue lotus flower. He saw how red smears of blood from wounds made by his arrows enhanced the beauty of the Lord's transcendental body. Bhishma had kept his promise and forced Krishna to break his own. Arjuna was acting in the fraternal ras, so he grabbed Krishna around the waist to check his assault on Bhishma. Arjuna pleaded with Krishna not to break his promise and become known as a liar. Krishna could appreciate Arjuna's concern, but he deliberately went back on his word. He broke his vow to show that he protects his devotee unconditionally, at whatever cost to himself, even if he loses his reputation. Nothing supersedes Krishna's love for his devotees. So Krishna was magnificent in protecting Arjuna and in breaking his promise. And Bhishma relished this in ecstasy, just as he relished Krishna's stern military features as Krishna maneuvered Arjuna's chariot with a whip in his right hand and the bridle in his left hand. Instead of Krishna with a flute, Bhishma saw Krishna with a whip and a bridle. And Krishna displayed these features to satisfy Bhishma's chivalrous love. And Bhishma pressed his attack on Krishna to satisfy the Lord's fighting spirit. These arrows that fell on Krishna were actually like worship by Bhishma, a kind of worship. Krishna accepted them like a shower of roses offered by a devotee. He enjoyed the wounds inflicted by Bhishma, although in truth there was no possibility of wounds on the spiritual body of Krishna. But just as intense love can cause a person to blush, cause the skin to turn red, So Krishna responded in love to Bhishma with the appearance of wounds on his body. In this way, Krishna accepted the love offered to him by Bhishma. So now, in this section of the chapter, where it's after the battle, Bhishma is fixing his mind with intense concentration on Krishna's image and how they exchanged, how he and Krishna exchanged love on the battlefield. Any questions?
Yeah, you mentioned how of the different rasas, the five primary rasas are in the heart, and the seven indirect are according to circumstances. I just don't know, where is that stated?
It's in Ravindra Shroop's article, so I assume it's also in the Nectar of Devotion.
I just don't recall in Nectar of Devotion. I just was wondering.
What? Please?
The seven indirect rasas. I just don't recall that. And I know the seven indirect, but as far as it's going to circumstance, okay. All right. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Bhrigupati Prabhu.
Thank you, Pooh, for a very scholarly, well thought out, well presented, and interesting class. Thank you. My question is this: is it possible to experience rasa before one is on the transcendental platform? It's like while one is still within the modes of material nature, can you actually experience rasa?
We can experience it by hearing about it, just like we can experience a foreign country we've never gone to by reading about it. What is the characteristics of a particular country? What do we expect to see when we get there? What language do they speak? So by hearing the Bhagavatam, we are on the absolute platform if we hear purely, and we experience by hearing, just as we experience God in His holy names, by hearing His holy names, or we experience Krishna's devotional service by intense engagement in Krishna's service. When the pujaris are working minute by minute, hour by hour throughout the day, or the book distributors are intensely engaged, or in any service that we do, when we're absorbed in that service, our senses are withdrawn from these polluted temporary relationships in this world, and we get a sense of what a relationship in the spiritual world is like. So as we advance and become more clear about our rasa, our eternal rasa, we'll have a clearer, more intense idea of rasa. But even now we can get some sense of it.
So I just want to make sure I understood you correctly. So as soon as one is engaged in a devotional service according to the authorities, bona fide direction.
Sorry, one is, I couldn't hear you bigger.
As soon as one is engaged, as soon as one is worshiping the deity or performing sankirtan, that person is experiencing rasa, but not necessarily in its the full experience. It's you're because you have to, but you're in a rasa at that point from the moment you're engaged.
We hear the services we do engage our senses, and we're withdrawn. Just like in a yoga, Bhishma is described as his senses were withdrawn, the inauspiciousness of material activities was stopped. That can happen when we do our intense services. But the experience of rasas, mostly we'll get that now from hearing the Bhagavatam, descriptions of Krishna's pastimes with devotees in rasas.
Okay, I have to think about that. I'm sure.
Or the Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Yeah, thank you.
By hearing the Shastra from a pure devotee. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.